Today on Life and Faith.
What I didn't realise at the time is that it's complete illusion. Like, it is that, to sell that to the wider public. But at the time, as a young person that has never really felt that beautiful, has never had their hair and makeup done in those contexts or had to wear these beautiful dresses or been on professional television sets, it was just an absolute dream.
Why are we here? Can I have a relationship with God? These kinds of things I can't measure with my microscope or my telescope.
Hope deranges us. Hope breaks things and breaks things down.
Christianity isn't some kind of self-help doctrine. It's not probiotics for the soul or something, you know?
He was using the parable of the Good Samaritan
to justify bombing Syria.
Welcome to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
We get to talk to a lot of interesting people on this podcast. This year, that's included a rabbi, a Nigerian YouTube star, and a cold case detective. To date, though, our most popular episode ever was an interview with Australian actor Anna McGann.
Shall we find out how it ends?
I don't want it to end.
Everything ends unless you stay in between. It's easier there.
In between. What does that mean?
Anna's breakout role was in the Australian series Underbelly, and you might also recognise her from much-loved shows like Anzac Girls, House Husbands, the Dr. Blake Mysteries, and, as you've just heard, the 2018 series Picnic at Hanging Rock. A few years ago, Anna shared with us a bit about her story and how she went from being fiercely anti-Christian to finding a lot of things that she didn't expect in Jesus and in the church.
Our download figures suggest that that story really struck a chord with people, so we were really excited to hear that Anna had decided to tell it more fully in the form of a memoir.
It was actually a lot more difficult than I expected it to be. And what I charged myself with initially was to basically place no filter in it, to write the truth down as I saw it, my version of the truth, and go to the harder places or the rooms that are usually locked. That's sort of the metaphor I guess I try and use with it. The rooms that I don't like to go into, I decided I will go into them for this book.
It's called Metanoia, and it's a beautiful meditation on a life intensely lived, on pain and creativity and wanting more.
Quite early on in the process, I came across the word metanoia, or as one Greek lady pronounced to me, metanoia, although I know I'm probably perverting it. I don't know how I'm saying.
Sounds legit to me.
But it is a Greek word, and it means transformational change of heart. And it's a word that is used in many, many contexts to sort of describe transformation. But it's also used, interestingly, in the New Testament, in the Bible, as the word that means repentance. And repentance has a lot of baggage as a word, but the word metanoia doesn't translate that same way. The word that is actually used with this word of, you know, this sort of sense of an overwhelming transformation or a deep transformation that changes everything, I found to be more poignant and accurate.
I guess when you look back on your own story to tell it, you see some threads that aren't necessarily obvious to you at the time. A big one for Anna is The Body. The subtitle to her book is A Memoir of a Body Born Again. The book has a lot of metaphors for the body. The body as a marketplace or as a stranger, a tool for trade or for consumption, or ultimately for Anna as a friend, a sanctuary, an inheritance. There are lots of relationships that unfold in Metanoia, but the big one is really between Anna and her body. I asked her what she thinks went wrong between the two of them.
I guess one word to describe it would be a divorce of sorts, though I can't even now pinpoint necessarily why that happened or the first case in which it did. But it was something that really marked my adolescence and then the years that followed on from that. And it was, I suppose, a divorce that looked like an estrangement and even a hatred, and just this sense of I'm not at home in my own body. I don't like the way my body looks, and I don't like the way my body feels, and I don't like the fact that I'm stuck within it. And I guess the way that that manifested for me as a young person was with a very serious eating disorder. And I suppose from that point, and that eating disorder did continue for a long time, but when I was a young person, I was hospitalized for it. And I survived the experience, obviously, but it really threatened my family and I guess my own sense of what am I doing here? Why am I still alive? Why have I been spared, even though I tried so hard to diminish and destroy myself? And then it's sort of the pendulum almost swung into this desire for consumption and experiencing everything that I possibly could and going, well, you know, if I have to be stuck in this body, then I'm going to try every drug and, you know, sleep with every person and engage with any possible experience, no matter if it hurts me, because I disregarded it, I suppose, as a vessel so much. And so I suppose as I tracked my spiritual journey, I realized that it was a very physical journey as well, because the estrangement with my own body really mirrored a spiritual estrangement as well.
Acting wasn't always the plan for Anna, but her studies took this direction during university days, and when she graduated, she almost immediately landed a series of high-profile jobs.
I had such small expectations on myself, I suppose, as a performer. And I don't say it with this sense of false humility, but I genuinely hadn't felt at home as an actor when I was training. I enjoyed it. I really loved it and pursued it. But it had never fit. I'd always wanted to be a writer. And I'd gone into university to study psychology because I needed a real job. And then had found myself really drawn in by the world of theatre and the world of film and thought. It sort of played with this idea of escapism to me. Acting did this idea, oh, I could be other people. I don't have to be this person that I really don't quite like. I could play all these different other people. And I could use my the emotions that I have that are so overwhelming to me in all these other different ways. And I found it intoxicating. And a lot of people have that experience initially of just, this is the drug, this is it. And so I went to acting school, which was no mean feat either. Like, you have to get in. And I think my whole family were like, well, let her audition. This is never going to go anywhere. And somehow I got in and somehow got through the 3 years, but never necessarily excelled. And I sort of said to myself, at the end of this, I'll just become a playwright. And it's been a really good learning experience. And I've got as far as I can get. But, you know, I know how to view this industry. I know I have to be realistic, and I know that it's brutal. And so when I came out of acting school and doors opened, I don't think I was mentally prepared. I think my naivety and my shock sort of sent me into this, sent me reeling. And I was very flattered and very excited. And whatever sort of came my way, I thought, well, this might be the only chance I get. I'll take it all. And it, you know, it is pitched as very glamorous, and it's immediately glamorous. But what I didn't realize at the time is that it's complete illusion. Mm. Like, it is that to sell that to the wider public. But at the time, as a young person that has never really felt that beautiful, has never had their hair and makeup done in those contexts or had to wear these beautiful dresses or been on professional television sets, it was just an absolute dream. So the first job that I got was a job on Underbelly Razor, and that was the fourth installment of Underbelly. At the time, it had received a lot of publicity. We were going back into the 1920s, and I was playing a 15-year-old prostitute. And not a stable character, very sociopathic, problematic character. And for an actor, very meaty. Like, it wasn't just sexualized content. It was these beautiful relationship dynamics, stuff to sink your teeth into. But there was a nudity element and a sexual element. And I just sort of shrugged at that and thought, you know what, I'm an actor. I can do that. I've, you know, I have a history as a dancer. you know, it's just another costume. What's the most harm it can do? And so I finished the project and it went to air and that was thrilling. But I didn't preempt a public reaction to my body or a public ownership of my body. And as someone that was still struggling with food and body image in a very deep way, I remember sitting in my car at one point and there had been an article in the paper about my weight or and how I'd gained weight or something like that.
Oh my goodness, it's and every woman's worst nightmare.
Truly. And I just sat in that car and sobbed. And I just remember being alone in a city. This is a little while after it had aired. And so my family live in Brisbane. I'd filmed the job in Sydney. I'd been doing other jobs in Melbourne. I was a gypsy. I didn't really have a home. You know, I was dependent on, will I get another job? It was just such an insecure lifestyle. And to sit in this space of going, I'd given everything and I'd received great praise and exposure for my brave performance, but at the same time I'd have men coming up to me on the street and commenting on my breasts. I'd have my image appearing on a pornographic website. And my sense of worth or my sense of owning my own sexuality even just completely disintegrated.
So Anna had kind of landed her dream job in a highly competitive industry, but as with a lot of things, it wasn't quite what she thought it would be. As her career progressed, things got more complicated, on screen and off. Here's how Anna describes this period in her book, Metanoia.
The season intensified. I felt invisible, exhausted. Thinking I needed more influences, I took on the traits I was observing. I was in and out of lust with different men and women, leading them on and letting them down, seeking out connection and severing it immediately. The body count started to block my path a little. There were only narrow trails left to follow. I wanted to be in love. I wanted to feel good at my job. I wanted my skin and fat and bones to drip off my soul, but I wanted to plant my roots deep down too. I wrestled the world for my body, furious. Why do you belong to everything else? To everybody else? Come back. I longed for all my desperate posturing to be replaced by something real, but I wasn't real. I was an actor.
I think it would be accurate to say that you were quite anti-Christian at this point in
Definitely.
Your life, but that doesn't mean that you weren't a spiritual person. Tell me a bit about your kind of spiritual seeking during all this.
I think I've always had a sensitivity to, dare I say, the supernatural. So I would never have classed myself as someone that was defiantly atheist, but I was defiantly anti-Christian in the sense that this idea of an exclusive deity or this idea of a set of rules to follow didn't appeal to me at all. And I was, I suppose, extremely liberal, not only in my value system, but in my lifestyle as well. And I felt really judged by the Christian ideology because I was part of the LGBT community and I was well known as this sort of sexualized actor. And so for me, spiritual searching, at an early stage, I really rejected nominal Catholicism, which is what I'd somewhat been raised in. And I was really curious about, you know, just little things like yoga, meditation, Buddhism. And that sort of got a little deeper. And I was fascinated by some of the more new age depths of spirituality. And I trained in Reiki and in how to be a Reiki practitioner. And I went to Vietnam and Nepal to really seek out a lot of Buddhist ideals and teaching and did courses and saw some very strange and beautiful things in those contexts. Really felt like I was tapping into something that had spiritual power. I was aware, I was like, I know something's there because I've interacted with it and I somehow have a sensitivity to it. But I was constantly frustrated, I suppose, because
I wanted the answers. I wanted whatever it was, I wanted it. And there were just always these obstacles, and usually they were financial. Usually someone was like, you can learn about this if you pay this amount of money to come to this course and get, you know, retuned to the frequency of this Reiki thing, and then you get that. Or even in my experience in Nepal was, you know, come to this temple and pay a lot of money to get a blessing. And I was just thinking, there's something incongruent about this. It doesn't make sense to me. If there is God, God's supposed to be free. And I sort of had this sense that I was buying into something that was possibly commodified, maybe a bit of a lie, but I'd gone so far down the rabbit hole at this stage that I thought, I'm just keep at it because I've got nothing else.
So what shifted that made you willing to reconsider Christianity as a genuine spiritual option?
The shift was relational. I made some friends, that unexpected friends that happened to be Christian believers. And I had never really had Christian friends. It had never occurred to me that I could be friends with Christians. And so when it was revealed that these people that I quite admired believed in Jesus, I was quite taken aback and a little bit put off. But I wanted answers. I thought, well, there's got to be some reasoning behind this. It confronted me. They were actually quite reserved, and I sort of had to poke them a little bit and prod and sort of fish a little bit for a bit more information. And not that much came my way until I propositioned a male friend who I was quite attracted to and basically said, I think that we should date. And he just said an outright no. And I had been, I suppose, in a season where I'd been dating very casually and I'd been working in television, and I suppose I'd had a few experiences where people weren't that interested in getting to know me very deeply, but there was a sense of, well, this person's, you know, working on this television show at the moment, I'll give her a whirl. That's honestly what it felt like. I wasn't used to having people say no, men or women. And for this man to just say, no, I'm not going to date you, it's part of my faith, I'm a Christian, was just baffling. It sounds so arrogant. But I guess I'd been in that mindset, and it wasn't that I held myself so highly. It's I held myself so low that I didn't, it was just whatever.
Not a big deal.
No. It didn't even have to be serious. And he said to me, if you ever want to talk about it, we can. He lived in Melbourne and I was visiting that city at the time. And so we sat down in this bar and had this conversation, and I thought, okay, once he realizes how spiritual I am, he'll see that I have a lot of depth and that I am worth dating. It became my mission. I was like, well, for that evening anyway. But I didn't talk at all that night. And I thought that he might talk about God, and I was prepared for that. And I was a bit worried that he might talk about Jesus because I wasn't really prepared for that word. But he actually talked about the Holy Spirit. And he was a creative, and he talked about how the Holy Spirit helped him in his creative process and was almost like a muse that inspired him. And I just thought, that's so strange, because I've had experiences like that. He's describing something I have experienced. He's describing something I think I know. How could that possibly be? And I listened to him talk for about 3 hours, and at the end of the conversation he said, well, I have to go now, but if you're ever back in Melbourne, you could visit my church one day if you were interested. And I just sort of rolled my eyes and thought, there's just no way, mate. This is the end of our friendship, and that's okay. But, you know, thanks for the chat.
This is Life and Faith, and Natasha's speaking with Australian actor Anna McGann about her new memoir. We've got to the turn in Anna's story, the point where everything shifts. Here's how she tells it in the book.
I've let you examine my forging forward and predict just how low I might go before desperately clawing about in the dirt for the idea of God. I don't mind it. We have to traverse that part of the heart. You have to judge me in order to trust me.
in order to accept if anything I say from this point in the story is true.
So at this point, Anna had met this guy. She liked him. He was like, I'm not going to date you because I'm a Christian. And she went, okay, that's the end of that. Which is not how things played out.
And I flew back to Sydney and tried to think no more of it. And 3 nights later, I was at a party in Sydney, an industry sort of schmoozy booze-up thing. And this girl who worked in radio actually came up to me and said, I see you've been hanging out with this guy. What's the deal? And I said, there's no deal because he's a Christian. And she looked at me and she said, I'm a Christian. Do you want to talk about it? And so we sat there in this bar and I explained what I believed and why it was different, why it challenged me. And she explained what she believed. And she said to me very boldly, actually, I don't think the values that we hold are that different. I don't think that the way that you perceive spirituality to me is that different at all. In fact, I think you would love my church if you came to visit it. Do you want to come and visit it? And I don't know what happened in that moment, but I had felt so much resistance to it for so long. But when she invited me and actually told me that, she didn't even say, oh, you know, we'd accept you. It would be okay for you to come, but that I would approve of it, that I would love it. I felt genuinely welcome. And I just said, yes, great, I would love to. And so the next Sunday, I went to this tiny Anglican evening service in Sydney, a really eclectic little group of people. And I was so nervous. And I told all these people that I was going to mock it, and that it was a joke, and it was like not a big deal at all. And but secretly just felt very hungry, just for something. I just thought, what is this mysterious thing that these people have given themselves to that I don't know about, that I seem to not have access to? And so I walked through the threshold of this church and straight away had this physical experience. And it was as though my hands were on fire. And it was significant because all of the other spiritual experiences I had had doing Reiki or in yoga or any of the things I'd pursued, I had had these manifestations in my hands or in physical ways. But this was beyond. This was much, much more. I saw a vision of light falling from the sky, and I had this overwhelming sense of purity, that whatever the spirit was that was in that room that I was accessing was good, and it was safe, and I could trust it. And I had never experienced that. And I just trusted. It was very strange. I didn't make sense of the Bible readings. I didn't really make sense of the liturgical structure of the whole thing. In fact, it all made me feel very uncomfortable, but I knew I was safe. And I sat in that pew and I cried. And so a week or two later, I found out that I had a job, a new acting job, and I was moving to Melbourne. And the guy that I had been speaking to about God lived down there and was basically the only person that I knew. The beautiful thing was that I had felt for so many years that I was only worth something to people if I was on TV, or if I could give them some degree of leverage, or I could give them whatever they wanted. And I had felt as though I wasn't really worth getting to know. And I'd almost positioned myself that way to this guy and to other people there, to just be like, well, I could offer you myself. I could offer you my body. I could, like, I've got these different contacts. I'm working in TV. Like, just get to know me. And what he did was he invited me to meals with his friends. And so for the first time in a long time, people would sit with me, and instead of asking me about my job, they would ask me how I was, how my heart was. And we talk about the deeper things of life. And it was sort of through those friendships. And this was only a brief time, and they invited me to come to, they all went to church together, and I knew that. And I was very suspicious of it. I wasn't quite ready, but they invited me to a small group. And I walked into that space and felt again, extremely uncomfortable, but they just shared a meal together. And I sort of went away that night and I had been moved by it. And I just thought, you know what, this is going a bit too far. I'm vulnerable. I'm alone in this city. I'm starting a new job. I'm hurting. Clearly, I'm just being brainwashed. I know that this is a bigoted ideology. I know that that Christianity is wrong. And I need to get over this once and for all. And so my plan was, I'll go home to my hotel room and there will be a Gideon Bible in the drawer and I'll read the Gideon Bible and I will show myself firsthand what it says and that it does preach hell and damnation. It does tell me that I'm a terrible person, that it is just a bunch of crock, basically. I'll prove it to myself and I can get over it and move on with my career because, you know, I could feel that it was getting in the way. And so I did that. I went home. And over 2 weeks, I read the four Gospels, so the four stories about Jesus, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And I opened up the first sort of page, and I can't explain it, but it just was true. I just believed it. And there wasn't even this question or skepticism of like, you know, well, so it says, but, you know, where is it back to? There was just this, somewhere or somehow in the story was just this sort of fragrance of truth. And so as I read it, and I read about this person of Jesus that I realized very quickly I had actually never heard about, not properly, I was completely undone. Because the way that the media or this idea of Christianity had pitched it to me was that Jesus didn't like me, he didn't want me, he wasn't interested in me at all until I conformed to this version of what righteousness should look like. And what I discovered was this was a person who said, I hate judgment and I hate hypocrites and I do not ask you to do that. Exactly as you are, I'm your friend and I'm your ally and I'm yours and I'm with you. And even when everybody else hates you, I'll still stand by your side. And I just clung to that. I grabbed him as though nobody else knows this guy. This guy is mine. He's with me. And I felt so seen and so loved. And I think on a deeper level than that, I felt as though I had permission to be more than the box I'd always been put in. And I remember so clearly this one scripture. I took it completely out of context, but Jesus is chatting to a whole bunch of people and he tells them, you are the light of the world. And I read that and I took it to heart immediately, not because I felt like it validated my point of view about myself, but because I had never heard words like that spoken over my life. I had never considered that I could be a force of goodness or light or kindness. I just wasn't. And it permeated me. And what's more, it permeated my body. So 2 weeks into this process, I got up one morning and I had been feeding myself on these beautiful ideas, on these beautiful affirmations that my body was a temple, that I was light, that I was valued and that I was loved. And I looked in the mirror and I just thought, what have I done? And the eating disorder that I'd had for about 10 years vanished and stopped that day. And what was more, it delved into deeper parts too, into sexuality and worth. And it just felt like I had permission to say no. I had permission. It wasn't this, well, you know, as a Christian, you don't have sex, so you need to stop. It was this, you don't have to do that to get love anymore. That's not the transaction. In fact, there is no transaction. You're worthy of love without giving anything to anybody. And it just felt like permission. And I grabbed it. And I just thought, I'm yours now. I'm free.
There are lots of things I love about Anna's book. I love the way that the different cities where she lives are like their own characters in the book, Brisbane and Sydney and Melbourne and LA. I love the honesty of it. I love the story of healing that unfolds, especially with the birth of her daughter, which was not at all easy and was something that she wasn't sure would or could happen for her. The poet Chaucer famously wrote at the end of one of his tragedies, "Go, little book," you know, imagining his work, his offspring, going out into this potentially rough world. I asked Anna where she pictures her story going from here.
For me, it's like a seed, or hopefully a bunch of seeds, because it's been printed multiple times now. All you can ask is that some of these stories or things that you have lived, some of them very difficult, some of them, you know, thrilling because they're miracles or things like that, can be a source of growth and hope for somebody else. And I intentionally wrote it not as a preaching tool, I suppose, or to say this is how God works, because he is not to be boxed, but to indicate, well, this is one example of how God has worked in one person's life. And if he is this wild and untamable and beautiful and generous, that means he can be that wild and generous to you. You know, I'm not special. I'm one little person that got to experience a really beautiful thing, and quite extraordinary thing. And I want it to be permission giving, I suppose. That's my real hope, is that someone can go, you know what, even if everything else is falling apart, I know that he did that for her. And that I can hold on to that. I can hold on to the memory of reading that story.
This has been Life and Faith with me, Simon Smart.
And me, Natasha Moore.
Anna McGann's book is called Metanoia, a memoir of a body born again. And it's out now with Acorn Press.
As always, we'd love you to share this conversation with other people. And if you're a regular Life and Faith listener and you like what we do, then leave a rating or review for us. It helps us grow our audience.
Next week.
It was interesting to live on a housing estate in the middle of a war zone. If you're a working class family, even from Britain to the sunshine of Perth, living in an asbestos house near the beach, that's, you know, the battler's blocks, but it's, you know, it's very much a Tim Winton view of the world.
It was next to Fremantle. It's not exactly the worst place to live.
Yeah. And then you move back to mid-Ulster in the middle of a war zone, and it's raining all the time. Your parents are unemployed, and you've got baby brother and another on the way, and no money. It's a very unusual setting. But actually, I didn't feel very upset by that. I felt more upset about going back to Perth.
I remember that. Yeah. I remember you feeling much more upset about going back to Perth.
Yeah. And vowed to return to the UK, or what I thought was the UK, but it's... Portadown is not the UK.